on multiple occasions dating back to the early 1990s, none of the professional organizations to which he belonged did much about it, at least until 2008. Because of their inaction, Hain could continue citing his affiliation with those groups when vouching for his credentials in court. "It's a problem," says Vincent DiMaio, a renowned medical examiner and author of several textbooks on forensic pathology. "You have to understand that these organizations are toothless. They publish guidelines, but then don't have the guts to sanction members who violate them. They don't want to be sued. With the exception of the American Board of Pathology, membership in these groups doesn't mean competence. But juries can be misled into seeing it that way. Too many judges and attorneys don't know to point out the difference." In August 1995, Young wrote to Sperry again. She claimed to have found two civil cases in which she alleged that Hain had committed perjury. In one case, Hain claimed to have formed his opinion after reviewing some microscopic slides. But the doctor who performed the original autopsy testified under oath that not only had he never given the slides to Hain, the two had never spoken. In the other case, Hain testified that he had reviewed slides from an autopsy conducted by a doctor who actually worked in Young's lab. Young would have been the person who sent the slides from that case to Hain. "As the custodian of records and materials for this laboratory," she wrote, "I can and will testify that I have not sent these materials to him, nor has he appeared in our office to review them." In a subsequent court filing, Hain's attorney called the perjury accusations untrue and defamatory, and claimed they painted Hain in a false light. "As you can see," Young wrote, "the evidence is mounting, and we are attempting to handle matters on a local level. However, the time is drawing near to have some action on a national scale." Sperry later alleged to Young and McCormick that he had consulted on a case in which a body Hain had autopsied was exhumed. In his autopsy report, Hain claimed to have removed, weighed, and dissected the decedent's internal organs. But when Sperry opened up the body after exhumation, all the organs were still inside and still intact. McCormick later gave court testimony about a conversation with the Tennessee State Medical Examiner, who told him Hain first failed to produce slides in a case in which he had found cancer on a kidney, and then produced slides that had nothing on them. When Hain got word of the complaints filed against him, he filed notice of his intent to sue Young and McCormick, alleging libel, conspiracy, and tortious interference with and injury to business and contractual relations. The lawsuit was later dismissed when Hain failed to serve the summons and complaint. Of course, a lawsuit would have opened his records up to discovery, which could have been damaging for him. But he certainly sent a message. Criticize him, and you could expect to spend some time in court. The lifeless body of 23-month-old Haley Olivo lay awkwardly across a metal autopsy table at Mississippi Mortuary Services in Pearl. A red block propped under her shoulders elevated her chest, causing her head to tilt backward and her arms to spill off to the side. The toddler's head hung at an angle that caused her fine blonde hair to fall away from her face, exposing her right cheek, the right side of her forehead, and her hairline. There was light bruising around her ear and right eye, but there were no visible scrapes, cuts, or abrasions on the right side of her face. More importantly, the skin of her right cheek was smooth and unblemished. In a heavy drawl, Michael West's voice announced the date and time, December 18, 1993, 9:35 p.m. Olivo had drowned in a bathtub that morning in West Monroe, Louisiana, while in the care of her mother's boyfriend, Jimmy Duncan. Allison Olivo left for work at around 8:45 a.m. Duncan told police he put the girl in the tub and then went to do some dishes. When he returned to the bathroom to dry her off, he found her in the water. Haley lived a short and unhappy life. Her parents had divorced, and her father was in prison. She lived with Duncan and her mother in West Monroe. In early November 1993, She was twice taken to the hospital after suffering seizures. That same month, she was again admitted to the hospital. This time, her mother said the girl had pulled a chest of drawers down on top of herself while climbing to reach for a piggy bank. She suffered multiple skull fractures and some bruising on her left elbow. An investigation by the West Monroe Police Department and Ouachita Parish Child Protective Services found no evidence of abuse. Still, to Allison Olivo's family, it seemed suspicious. They didn't much care for Duncan. He and Allison both used drugs. At the very least, they thought he was bad for Allison and Haley. Even a charge of negligent homicide would be difficult to win. Olivo was nearly two. Perhaps leaving her in a bathtub for 10 to 15 minutes wasn't prudent parenting, but it was far from clear that it was criminal conduct. But the county's law enforcement officials had recently heard about the two forensic experts in Mississippi who were promoting cutting-edge technology to find bites, bruises, and other wounds that no one else could see. So they turned to Stephen Hain and Michael West. Perhaps they could find the evidence the state needed to put Jimmy Duncan away. Haley Olivo's body was sent 120 miles east to Mississippi Mortuary Services in Pearl. A police chief, a police detective and captain, and two assistant district attorneys went with the body and witnessed the autopsy. That wasn't unusual, but it also wasn't recommended. The National Association of Medical Examiners encourages doctors to maintain their independence, for example, by avoiding interactions with investigating law enforcement officials before conducting exams. Such interaction can bias a doctor's conclusions. In fact, studies have shown that the more details crime lab analysts know about a case before conducting their analysis, the more likely they are to come up with false positives. A search of court records suggests that the Olivo case was one of Hain's first in Ouachita Parish. Hain got the job at about the time he and West had begun advertising their services in northern Louisiana. Within a year, he was getting nearly all the parish's autopsies. In his initial examination on the night of December 18th, Hain suspected the presence of possible bite marks on Olivo. He called in Michael West. The following morning, West concurred with Hain, noting bite marks on the girl's elbow and near her ear. In a subsequent examination, West declared that those marks were consistent with Jimmy Duncan's teeth. More importantly, he also claimed to have found a mark on her cheek that he said was a positive match to Duncan. For his part, Hain determined that Olivo had been forcibly drowned, and said he found lacerations on her anus that the state would later suggest were indicative of sexual abuse. District Attorney Jerry Jones charged Duncan with capital murder, alleging he had raped Olivo in the bathtub, forced her head underwater, bitten her, and drowned her. Jones would seek the death penalty. The video of West's examination of Haley Olivo wouldn't see the light of day for another 15 years when Jimmy Duncan's post-conviction attorneys found a copy of it in the prosecutor's file. In it, West examined Olivo twice. The first 5 minutes of the video took place on December 18th. During this portion of the video, West makes no mention of any scrapes or abrasions on Olivo's cheek, and there are no such injuries apparent on the tape. At the 4 minutes 57 seconds mark, there's a break in the video, marking the lapse between the two exams. The video picks up on the following day, December 19th. The camera returns to Haley Olivo's face. Strikingly, where the first video had showed no blemishes at all, a conspicuous abrasion now appears to the right of Olivo's mouth. West's hand then enters the frame, holding a plaster dental mold taken earlier that day from Jimmy Duncan. West then repeatedly presses the front part of the dental mold directly into the mark on Olivo's cheek. Over the next 2 minutes of the video, he does this 17 times. At another point, he drags Duncan's mold across Olivo's face, beginning near her lips, then scraping the plaster teeth down her face to her jaw. He does this for another minute. West then moves to Olivo's elbow and pushes Duncan's dental mold onto an old bruise that, according to Duncan's attorneys, hospital records showed she had suffered weeks before her death, after the chest of drawers incident. West would later claim that the mark was inflicted by the back right side of Duncan's upper teeth. At the 9 minutes 32 seconds mark, West asks an assistant in the room to turn out the lights. A fluorescent black light then flickers on. This is the West phenomenon in action. With the lights out, West continues to jam the plaster cast into the girl's cheek, elbow, and arm. Over the course of the 24-minute video, West pushes, drags, or scrapes the cast of Duncan's teeth into and onto the girl's body at least 50 times. West had described this method in court testimony in previous cases, but this was the first known time it had been captured on video. Forensic experts who watched the video were astonished. "This is the best documentation I've ever seen of Dr. West's junk bite mark comparisons," said Michael Bowers, a deputy medical examiner for Ventura County, California, after viewing the video in 2009. Bowers was one of the earliest critics of West, and later of bite mark analysis in general. How did Haley Olivo get abrasions on her cheek that weren't there the day before? "Dr. West created them," Bowers said. "It was intentional. He's creating artificial abrasions in that video, and he's tampering with the evidence. It's criminal. You never jam a plaster cast into a possible bite mark like that. It distorts the evidence." West would later call Bowers' accusations a damn lie. After watching the video, Bowers offered to submit an affidavit for Jimmy Duncan's defense. Several other specialists, including a forensic pathologist and the former president of the American Board of Forensic Odontology, submitted affidavits in Duncan's defense after viewing the tape. Others, like the celebrated forensic pathologist Michael Bodden, suggested that the marks may have been caused by the removal of medical tape from Olivo's cheek, but still insisted they weren't human bites. Duncan's post-conviction attorneys found the video in late 2008. It was never shown at his trial. That's in part because West himself didn't testify either. The years between his examination of Olivo in 1993 and Duncan's trial in 1998 were the years during which West had been exposed in media reports and disciplined by three different forensics organizations. By 1995, Duncan's prosecutors concluded that West came with too much baggage. They dropped him from the case and began looking for another bite mark analyst to replace him. Because even the prosecution had conceded that West had credibility issues, Duncan's attorneys requested that Olivo be exhumed so that their own expert wouldn't need to rely on notes from Hain and West. They were denied. Any expert for Duncan's defense would have to testify based only on the notes of the two Mississippi experts. Duncan was tried in 1998. Incredibly, the video of West's examination was never shown at trial. Even Duncan's own expert witness never saw it. The state at first had trouble finding a bite mark analyst who would testify from West's work, but eventually brought on Neil Reisner, a dentist from Scarsdale, New York. Using only the photographs West took after his examination of Olivo, Reisner concluded that the marks on the girl's cheek were indeed bite marks, and that, to a reasonable medical dental certainty, he could say they were made by Duncan. He also said that the marks on the girl's ear and elbow were consistent with Duncan's dentition, even though, again, according to Duncan's attorneys, hospital records indicated that particular injury was weeks old. Duncan's defense opted to go after West personally rather than attack the credibility of bite mark evidence in general. They put on the stand Richard Souveron, a well-known bite mark analyst and an evangelist for the field. In recent years, he had also become one of Michael West's most vocal critics. Souveron, who hadn't seen the examination video, testified that the mark West claimed to have found on Olivo's cheek wasn't a bite mark at all. The state also put on a jailhouse informant who claimed Duncan had confessed to him while the two shared a cell. Years later, other inmates would contradict the informant, giving sworn statements that Duncan had always maintained his innocence. By the time he retired, the police officer who solicited that informant's testimony had solicited 5 murder confessions from 3 suspects, all of which turned out to be false. But the jailhouse informant, the anal injuries, and the bite marks were enough to convince the jury of Jimmy Duncan's guilt. In 1998, he was convicted and sentenced to death. After the video was reported in the press in 2009, West declared that the forensic experts who sharply criticized his work in the case were part of a conspiracy against him. "I'm a little old dentist from Hattiesburg, and I've got the top lawyers in the country coming after me," he told the Clarion Ledger. Oddly, he claimed he was merely following a protocol developed by Bowers himself. When asked about this, Bowers laughed and said, "Oh my, that's absurd. That guy is crazy." "She was raped and sodomized and held underwater by this son of a bitch," West told the paper. "Now I'm the bad guy because this guy raped a 2-year-old. I'm tired of being beaten up because of the death penalty." There were additional problems with Hain's role in Duncan's case. As he had in other cases, Hain didn't turn over the slides he had made of the wounds he found around Olivo's rectum to Duncan's post-conviction attorneys. He claimed he no longer possessed them. The slides were critical to determine whether or not those wounds were from sexual abuse or, as the defense suspected, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, a condition brought on by anti-seizure medications that can cause blistering and lesions on mucous membranes, including the anus. At trial, Hain testified that the wounds were consistent with sexual abuse and had been inflicted near the time of death. Since Duncan was the only one alone with Olivo before she died, that testimony was damning. But there was no other evidence of sexual abuse. No semen, pubic hair, or blood from Duncan was found on or in the girl. Hain should also have kept either the paraffin blocks from which duplicate slides could be made, or at minimum his written record of what the slides showed. He never sent either. Duncan's post-conviction attorneys also asked Hain for records related to any other autopsies he had performed that day. Hain responded that he was under no legal obligation to respond to an out-of-state subpoena, a strange claim, given that Hain had actively promoted himself to Louisiana's justice system and agreed to participate in Duncan's prosecution. When the attorneys got a Mississippi judge to compel Hain to turn them over, Hain said the records had been destroyed. As of this writing, Jimmy Duncan still sits on death row at Angola Prison. Emily Ward had made it clear that she wanted to be consulted in controversial cases, particularly high-profile murders, jail and prison deaths, and deaths in police custody. That just wasn't going to happen. Ward quickly learned what Lloyd White had learned. When prosecutors didn't like what she or one of her staff had concluded after an autopsy, they'd simply take the body to a private doctor, usually Hain, for an alternate opinion. More likely, they just didn't take the chance, and like Coahoma County Coroner Charles Scott, went around her from the start. Ward was barely in office a year before the Clarion Ledger ran an article with the subheadline, "State Medical Examiner Often Ignored in Probes." In fact, the coroners most likely to do an end run around Ward were those near Jackson, right in her backyard, mostly because that also happened to be Haynes as well. Ward's efforts to have autopsies done more objectively didn't sit well with the state's old guard. "She is at present undermining death investigations and prosecutions in Mississippi," said John T. Kitchens, the district attorney in Stephen Haynes' home county of Rankin. District Attorney Ed Peters added that he had confidence in Hain and another private pathologist he used, and that he found them reliable. Another district attorney asked, "Why should I forsake him?" referring to Hain. "I think you ought to dance with the girl who brought you." In one case, Ward was approached by defense attorneys about her work. As she was ethically obligated to do as both a forensic pathologist and the state medical examiner, she told them what she had found. This was unthinkable in Mississippi. So in March 1994, the state's old guard brought out the knives. Kitchens was the first to send a letter of complaint to Ward's boss, Public Safety Commissioner Jim Ingram. "It has recently come to my attention that on more than one occasion our state medical examiner has unnecessarily rendered aid to the defense of criminal defendants." Kitchens found this unacceptable. Kitchens argued that the job of the state medical examiner was to assist law enforcement. In a claim that must have come as quite a shock to the state's indigent defense bar, one of the most underpaid and under-resourced in the country, Kitchens complained, improbably, that the deck was already stacked against prosecutors. "The list goes on and on where examples can be made of the defendant's advantages," he wrote. Kitchens argued that defendants were free to hire their own experts, either with their own money or with court funding. He finally insisted that Ingram order Ward not to discuss any case with a criminal defense attorney unless she either was answering questions under oath or had explicit permission from the district attorney whose office was prosecuting the case. On the same day Kitchens wrote his letter, Ed Peters, the district attorney for Hinds County, also sent Ingram a similar letter. Kitchens was either posturing or badly informed. First, most criminal defendants in the state were indigent and had no way of hiring their own experts. And it was far from certain that the state's courts would give defendants funding for it. They often didn't. Second, Mississippi didn't and still doesn't have a statewide public defender system. It mostly relies on local attorneys appointed by the courts on a case-by-case basis. Over the years, national watchdog groups have issued stinging rebukes of the state's public defender system. The idea that defendants in the state had every advantage was laughable. More importantly, Kitchens had misstated the proper role of a state medical examiner. State-employed forensic pathologists are independent fact-seekers, not members of the prosecution or law enforcement team. The guidelines from the National Association of Medical Examiners, for example, instruct doctors to work cooperatively with, but independent from, law enforcement and prosecutors. The renowned medical examiner Vincent DiMaio stated it more succinctly in a 2010 interview with PBS's Frontline. "It's not supposed to be for the police or against the police or for a family or against a family. You're supposed to be impartial and tell the truth. When I was practicing as a medical examiner, I was glad to talk to the defense. I had absolutely no problem talking to the defense." Ingram passed the letters on to the DPS legal counsel for analysis. The agency's lawyers pointed out that Kitchens was a big defender of Hain, and that Hain and Ward had been sparring over control. But the counsel did agree with Kitchens on an important point. The office argued that the state medical examiner should never consult with defense attorneys without prior authorization from prosecutors. Again, that was not only contrary to the very concept of an independent medical examiner, but also inconsistent with Mississippi law, which authorized the state medical examiner to take control of any death investigation in the state in which she deemed it was necessary. The tension between Ward and the old guard continued to escalate. Hinds County Coroner Robert Martin, who had praised Ward's hiring the previous year, now complained to the Clarion Ledger that Ward was undermining coroners and prosecutors. Ward reasonably responded that her job wasn't to help either side win a case, but to offer opinions based on reasonable medical certainty, regardless of who was requesting them. "If I didn't," she said, "I would be contributing to the obstruction of justice." Ward did have at least some defenders. The Alcorn County coroner said he used her for all his autopsies and that she was the best and most professional medical examiner with whom he had ever worked. But it was a funeral director in Jackson who came closest to getting at the root of the problem. "For every state medical examiner, there's always been a problem with one of them. At least that's what the coroners say. I just can't believe there is something wrong with every state medical examiner that is appointed by the state." Later that month, perhaps sensing that yet another good medical examiner was slipping away, the The Clarion Ledger ran a strong editorial in support of Ward. The editorial recapped the long and contentious history with the state medical examiner's office, and it took swipes at Martin and his flimsy excuses for going around Ward. Coroners and prosecutors shouldn't be farming autopsies out to private pathologists, the paper opined. Whatever the reason, whether it's to help cronies, or the way we've always done it, or because they believe they can opinion shop for favorable interpretations, the practice must end. The editorial predicted that unless the counties started to get on board, we'll be right back where we were with an empty top slot. The battle in the press continued, with medical examiners from Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Tennessee, and Louisiana writing letters to the editor in support of Ward. But behind the scenes, the old guard stoked resentment. Scott County Coroner Joe C. Bradford complained that Ward doesn't seem interested in building up the local coroner's office as she is in building up her own office. He added, reiterating the complaints of Kitchens and Peters, "Dr. Ward wants us to turn over our death investigations totally to her office and then allow defense attorneys to work with her rather than the local coroners, and I don't think that's right." West in particular painted Ward as power-hungry and authoritarian, and peppered his criticism with personal attacks. One longtime former coroner described a Mississippi Coroners Association meeting West called in Hattiesburg in late 1994 to make his case for a united front against Ward. When the former coroner defended the state medical examiner, West accused him of having an affair with her. A former sheriff, citing West, described Ward as a bull dyke whose do-gooderism hampered criminal investigations. Ward's enemies couldn't decide if she was a lesbian or a floozy. They just knew they didn't want to be taking orders from her. Jim Ingram was torn. A longtime lawman and former FBI agent had become friendly with Hain and had vouched for Hain to be medical examiner before Ward's appointment. But Ward was also his hand-picked selection for state medical examiner and director of the crime lab. Now the two were on a collision course. Publicly, Ingram stood with Ward and encouraged the coroners to work with her. But privately, he sometimes sided with coroners in their disputes with her. His inability to pick a side not only undermined Ward's authority, it emboldened her critics. Finally, in January 1995, Michael West circulated a memo among state coroners that called for Ward's resignation. The petition laid out a series of grievances, including that Ward was trying to establish a political power base, was working with defense attorneys, was uncooperative, and was undermining the coroner's authority. Of the state's 82 coroners, 42 signed West's petition. West typed a memo before releasing the petition to the press. He told his fellow coroners, apparently without the slightest hint of self-awareness, that of the 20 to 25 coroners who supported Ward, many did so because they were afraid of her, as she has shown how vindictive she can be. He then urged them to support a new bill in the Mississippi legislature that would privatize the state medical examiner's office. That bill, West wrote, would remove the politics of the ME's office and place it in the real world that we all must work and live in. The Clarion Ledger picked up the story of West's petition a couple of months later. The paper contacted all 42 signatories and found that a healthy majority of them used Hain for all or nearly all their autopsies. They all had backing from their district attorneys to sign the petition. Some of the signatories had never actually worked with Ward. They merely repeated hearsay allegations against her. Others admitted that they only signed the petition out of solidarity with fellow coroners. Most said that the petition was the result of a power struggle between Hain and Ward. Hain had the good sense not to speak out about it, at least publicly. West went after Ward with abandon. He told the paper that he had privately complained to Ingram about Ward for months. "He's never been able to keep this woman under control." Forrest Allgood also attacked Ward, accusing her of lying on the witness stand during one of his murder trials. Ward denied the accusation. Jimmy Roberts told the paper that in encouraging more autopsies at the state lab, Ward was trying to put him out of business, as if Ward had some obligation to pad Jimmy Roberts's bottom line. At least some coroners did object to West's petition. Susan Cunningham of Jackson County told the paper that the petition was baseless and that it looked like a group of fifth graders had written it. L.W. Bump Calloway of Warren County, the only coroner in the state who was a certified crime scene investigator, said West didn't even bother asking him to sign because he knew Calloway would tell him off. "I have always found Dr. Ward and her staff to be extremely professional, competent, and willing to cooperate." Jim Ingram attributed the petition to the usual coroner politics. "No medical examiner has ever been able to survive the system in Mississippi," he told the Clarion Ledger. "Everyone has either left the state in disgust or been fired." He told the reporter he supported Ward, but that wouldn't last. A few days later, the Clarion Ledger ran another editorial in support of Ward. She was experiencing firsthand the petty politics of having to deal with the good old boy system of Mississippi coroners, the paper opined. They resent having someone, especially a woman, overseeing their work, and the mere fact that the power brokers in that system were attacking her can be seen as validation that she is doing a good job. 3 months later, Emily Ward resigned. A few days after resigning, she fired back in the Clarion Ledger. She pointed out to the paper that at the same time the state was paying for her office and a state-of-the-art lab, most of the state's autopsies were being done at Jimmy Roberts's privately owned morgue in Pearl. "There is a small faction of people who see an opportunity to make very lucrative income off the taxpayers' dollars," Ward said. "It is just incredibly frustrating to try to run a death investigation system when you are competing with people who want to make money off the system." In agitating for Ward's removal, Kitchens, Robert Martin, and her other political enemies had argued that she should be replaced by a bureaucrat instead of another doctor. This was also the thinking behind the privatization bill West was pushing. The old guard needed a state medical examiner's office to handle paperwork and process records, but they didn't need the hassle of any real oversight. They'd get exactly that. Soon the Mississippi Medical Examiner's Office would be run by a non-medical administrator. The position of state medical examiner would remain vacant for the next 15 years. Michael West couldn't resist gloating about his victory. "She, Ward, has attempted to destroy the death investigation system in Mississippi," he told the Clarion Ledger. "She seems to be a very incompetent individual." At the time West gave that quote, it had been just 3 months since his testimony helped send a second innocent man to prison. Chapter 11. Vessels of Wrath Fitted for Destruction. "It's just another day in America, and we have lost our sense of outrage." Forrest Allgood. As in LeVon Brooks's case, Forrest Allgood's opening statement in Kennedy Brewer's trial was understated. After briefly recounting the scene on the evening Christine Jackson disappeared, Allgood plainly promised the jury, "The state intends to prove to you simply that sometime either on the late evening of May 2, 1992, or in the early morning of May 3, 1992, Kennedy Brewer choked and killed a 3-year-old child, Christine Jackson, after he had sexually battered her." But even with Michael West's powers at his disposal, Allgood had a couple of problems. Based on the initial investigation by law enforcement, Gloria Jackson was also in the house during the time Christine disappeared, and Jackson told virtually the same story as Brewer. She had no idea precisely how or when the little girl went missing. The only difference was that there was no physical evidence linking Jackson to the crime. The only such evidence against Brewer came from West. Allgood could only hope that the narrative would somehow change from the time of the investigation and that Brewer's defense attorneys wouldn't notice. He was in luck. When Deputy Sheriff Bud Permenter initially interviewed Gloria Jackson at her house on that Sunday morning, he asked her when she had last seen Christine. Jackson responded that she saw Brewer pick Christine up off of their bed and place her on the pallet before they went to sleep. In the fall of 1992, when Brewer and Jackson were both facing possible capital murder charges, Permenter testified at a preliminary hearing for the case. Allgood asked him about that interview. "She saw this child being actually picked up out of the bed and put on a pallet next to the bed at that time?" "That is correct," Permenter answered. Later, at the same hearing, Permenter testified that Jackson had told him that the youngest child, who was sleeping in the bed with the couple, started crying. Brewer got up, retrieved a bottle and diaper for the baby, and came back to bed. Allgood then asked Permenter if Jackson had told him that when she woke up at that point, she again saw Christine sleeping next to the bed. He said she had. The narrative was clear. Jackson saw her daughter Christine after she got home that night. But by the time of the trial, 2.5 years later, the narrative had changed. Jackson was Allgood's first witness. Early in her testimony, the prosecutor asked her to describe what she saw when she returned home from the Santa Barbara Club and got ready for bed. This time, Jackson said, she saw what she thought was Christine. Allgood swooped in. "Now, let me stop you for a minute," Allgood said. "You said like you thought it was her. Did you see any arms?" "No," Jackson answered. "Did you see any legs?" "No." "Did you see her head?" "No." "What did you see him pick up, Mrs. Jackson?" "Nothing really, 'cause I wasn't really paying too much attention." As for the period of time that Jackson had claimed that Brewer had gotten out of bed to get a baby bottle and a diaper, Allgood simply asked, "At any time, did you ever see your daughter, Christine Jackson, in that house?" "No," Jackson answered. Back when Jackson was still suspected for the crime, Permenter said Jackson seemed certain that she saw the girl. Now that it was just Brewer on trial, she wasn't so sure. There is nothing in the official record of the case to explain why Jackson would so radically alter her story, but there is some compelling circumstantial evidence. Jackson had initially been charged as an accessory after the fact. That's because if Brewer committed the crime, according to her initial statements to Permenter, Jackson had to have known about it. But in the years between Jackson's arrest and Brewer's trial, the charges against her were dismissed. After that, Jackson not only changed her story, but also offered some new incriminating evidence. She claimed that soon after she and Brewer were arrested, the two of them got into an argument in the jail. As she taunted Brewer about what would happen to him in prison for being a child killer, Brewer allegedly retorted, "It should have been you, Jackson, that I killed." Jackson claimed that she contacted jail personnel soon afterward to alert them to Brewer's confession. But there's no written record of her having made any such contact, nor did Allgood produce anyone from the jail who could corroborate her claim. Unfortunately, when Brewer's lawyers cross-examined Jackson, they didn't appear to even notice that the story had changed, much less challenge Jackson on it, or ask in front of the jury if she had struck a deal with prosecutors. They never inquired why the accessory charge had been dropped. Without Gloria Jackson as a suspect, the prosecution could focus solely on Kennedy Brewer. In his testimony, Stephen Hayne noted that after having been submerged in water for several warm spring days, Christine Jackson's body had begun to decompose. He testified that he had observed skin slippage and putrefaction, both of which are common under those circumstances. He determined that Christine had been strangled to death. She hadn't died of freshwater drowning. As for the other suspicious marks, Hayne thought that they were bite wounds. That's when he called in Michael West. Anticipating what Brewer's lawyers would later argue, Allgood asked Hayne whether it was possible that those marks had been the result of decomposition or insect bites. Hain replied that based on his extensive experience, he could distinguish the types of marks that were the result of decomposition or insect activity. The marks on Christine's body were not from insect activity, he said. Once again, Hain allowed West to excise the skin that contained the alleged bite marks, which other forensic experts say is an abrogation of his duties as a medical examiner. At least 9 forensic specialists have reviewed the work of Hain and West in the case, and all 9 have concluded that it simply wasn't reasonable for them to have concluded that the marks on Jackson's body were human bites. All have said they were either insect bites or some other injury, but they were definitely inflicted after Jackson's death. Even medical examiner Michael Bodden, a friend of Hain who has at times defended him from critics, concluded, "In my opinion, Christine Jackson's skin damage should have been recognized as, predictably, having occurred after her death, given the conditions where and when the body was found. It is further my opinion that it was a serious mistake to misidentify the decomposition changes as being the result of an adult human bite mark." West's mounting trouble with various forensics professional organizations might have given your average prosecutor pause. Not Forrest Allgood. Neither Allgood nor West even made an effort to keep West's professional troubles out of the trial. Instead, they took a different tack. They would argue that West was right, and all his critics were jealous of him for it. West admitted on the stand that in recent years, a couple of courts had prevented him from giving certain types of testimony. And in other cases, charges against a suspect implicated by his analysis had later been dismissed. But he brushed off the investigations and criticisms as being from vastly ignorant scientists who were unable or unwilling to appreciate the value of his work because of either envy or their own professional limitations. West freely admitted that there was no known error rate in the field of forensic odontology. When asked if he knew his own individual error rate, West answered, "My first marriage ended in divorce. My second marriage is current. So, I made one mistake." The court reporter noted in a parenthetical that West laughed. The record doesn't reflect Kennedy Brewer's reaction. Nevertheless, to hear West tell it, there wasn't a forensic expert around who could match his pedigree. He went through all the usual highlights of his career, adding this time that he'd soon be featured in an upcoming hour-length documentary on the BBC. The documentary, as it turned out, would be critical of West. After the questioning about his qualifications, Brewer's lawyers asked the court to bar West from testifying. "Dr. West has no regard for the standard of reasonable degree of scientific certainty," they argued. They explained that his opinions were entirely subjective, that he had been caught misrepresenting facts in other cases, and that he had called bite mark analysis as much of an art as it is a science. Few people disagreed with any of that. Even most bite mark analysts admit that the field is subjective, more opinion than science. It was also well understood by all parties that West himself was a controversial figure. But Allgood and Brewer's lawyers were also only arguing about West personally, not the pseudoscience of bite mark matching in general. This was the position in which the courts often put the lawyers defending those accused by Michael West. They could argue either that West wasn't credible or that bite mark analysis wasn't credible. Both were true, but defense attorneys were usually forced to pick one or the other. In Brewer's case, as with so many others, neither argument would have been successful. Less than 2 years before, in the same county, the same court had allowed West's testimony to help convict and imprison LaVon Brooks. A few weeks before Brewer's trial began, West had helped secure a murder conviction in the bologna sandwich case. The judge in Brewer's trial was also the judge in that trial. A ruling finding that West or forensic odontology wasn't credible would have undone those and other convictions. It was a lot to ask of a district court judge. Not unreasonably, then, Brewer's lawyers retained their own bite mark specialist to rebut West specifically. That expert, Dr. Richard Souveron, not only disagreed with West's findings and the rigor of West's analysis, but told the jury that the marks on Christine Jackson weren't bite marks. Souvaron also chaired the American Board of Forensic Odontology, ABFO, committee that suspended West. At first blush, that would seem to make him an ideal foil for West. But it would backfire. Allgood's cross-examination of Souvaron was devastatingly effective. It was also incredibly misleading and took advantage of the Hobson's choice that put Brewer's attorneys in a bind. First, Allgood got Souvaron to concede that the ABFO had recently approved the same direct comparison method that West used in the Brewer case. Then he got Souvaron to admit that West was one of the leading bite mark analysts in the country, even a true pioneer. Finally, Allgood clearly had carefully reviewed the ABFO's guidelines, including the transcripts of several meetings of the executive board. He got Souvaron to admit that the ABFO actually had no hard and fast rules regarding how bite mark analysts should express probability when discussing their findings in court. Allgood pointed to one ABFO survey that found that 8% of the group's members disagreed with the language the ABFO recommended, but didn't require, to express an analyst's most confident conclusions. Reasonable medical, dental, scientific certainty. After getting Souvaron to concede all of that, Allgood moved in for the kill. "I'm curious, Doctor. Did y'all suspend 8% of your membership upon finding that out?" "Absolutely not," Souvaron answered. "Only Michael West, isn't that right?" Allgood then drove the point home. He asked if this business of forensic odontology is somewhat of an art. Souvaron said it was. Allgood's point was that Souvaron and the ABFO had unfairly targeted West. He was half right. The ABFO was singling out West, but not unfairly. What Allgood had demonstrated is that the entire field of bite mark analysis is bogus. At best, the ABFO was a loose confederation of dentists, most of whom moonlighted as crime solvers. Their techniques weren't uniform. They had no consistent standards, and the terminology they used to describe their findings was bound only by their own imaginations. West's only sin, at least within this group, was that his imagination was a bit too flamboyant. He was disciplined not because, indeed and without a doubt, was any less steeped in science than the terminology used by any other member of the ABFO. He was disciplined because his bombast and self-promotion had become an embarrassment to his colleagues. Michael West was definitely a liability. But the bite mark community also did a fine job of embarrassing itself without him. The real problem for Kennedy Brewer was that his attorneys had already conceded that bite mark analysis in general was a legitimate field. If the field itself was legitimate, and West's methods weren't significantly different from those of his fellow bite mark analysts, then there was no reason to keep West from testifying. So the trial judge ruled on the motion the same way the judges and appellate courts before him had. West could testify, but Brewer's attorneys could challenge him. Somehow that would make it all fair. Both the Daubert and Fry rules envisioned judges as gatekeepers who carefully distinguished good science from bad. In reality, judges tend to act more like ushers. Everyone is welcome. West resumed the stand and didn't miss a beat. He explained to Brewer's jury that he had begun his examination by comparing the unique features of the marks on Christine's body to the unique class and individual characteristics of Brewer's teeth. Class characteristics, West explained, are identifying features found in specific groups of objects. As a metaphor, he asked jurors to consider a box of flathead screwdrivers and a box of Phillips screwdrivers. Though each of the Phillips screwdrivers may be different sizes, they all display the same class characteristic, a Phillips head shape, which is not shared by the flathead screwdrivers. According to West, these same class differentiations can be seen in an individual's dentition, the arch, the shape of the jaw, an overbite or underbite, and so forth. By contrast, He explained that individual characteristics arise because of random wear and tear. They include things like chipped or broken teeth. Sometimes these individual characteristics aren't obvious, such as small cracks or other tiny imperfections on the biting surface of a tooth. All of that is true. The problem is that West claimed that these distinguishing characteristics are detectable in the marks that individual teeth leave on human skin. There's just no evidence that they are. Over pages and pages of the trial transcript, West displayed black and white photos for the jury as he walked them through his methods in excruciating detail. This was a man who had invented his own realm. It was a realm in which places most of us have never considered, the surfaces of our teeth, come alive, blown up on slides to reveal otherworldly landscapes of ridges, crevices, elevations, and depressions. According to West, these formations leave signature imprints when teeth rip into human skin. West's jargon must have sounded sophisticated to jurors. The exhaustive manner in which he described his procedures undoubtedly made him seem cautious, careful, and analytical. How could any lay juror find fault with what he was saying? Unlike the autopsy of Courtney Smith, West and Hain had recorded their examination of Christine Jackson. So in this case, West's direct comparison method was on video, though the judge ultimately refused to let it be shown at trial. The trial judge ruled that because the video depicted the doctors and assistants carrying on unrelated conversations, blaring music, and behaving in a callous manner, it was too prejudicial to show to the jury. Though the video has never been made public, Brewer's attorneys have seen it and have shown it to other forensic specialists. After viewing the video, David Senn, another bite mark analyst, wrote in 2011 that during the examination, Dr. West placed Kennedy Brewer's dental models directly onto Christine Jackson's body multiple times with sufficient force to create visible marks. This was now the second time a forensic specialist had suggested that West's direct comparison method actually created the very bite marks later used to implicate a suspect. West wrapped up his testimony on March 23rd. Earlier that day, the court had been informed of an urgent problem. A rumor circulated that later that night, the TV news program 2020 would air an unflattering exposé of West and his novel bite mark theories. So just before dismissing everyone for the night, the judge gave some unusual instructions to the jury. "Also, it has been my understanding that for this evening, and for this evening alone, the television sets have been removed by the management of the hotel from your rooms," he said. There was indeed a news program preparing an exposé of West, ABC News Special Report with John Stossel. But the episode wouldn't air for another 2 years. Kennedy Brewer's attorneys had their own problems to address at trial. The first was the state's claim that no one other than Brewer had access to the house during the time that Christine Jackson disappeared. Brewer himself, along with Jackson, had agreed that the locking mechanism on the front door, the bent nail, was accessible only from the inside. And Brewer, from the very first moment he was questioned by the deputy sheriff, was adamant that no one came in the front door that night except Gloria Jackson, whom he let in when she returned from the club. The window was a different story. The state claimed there was no sign of forced entry at any point near or on the window. The broken window pane, they discovered from Jackson, had been broken when she moved into the house. It was not the result of someone prying or forcing it open. But ironically, the very certainty with which the state made this point ultimately undermined it. 4 law enforcement officers claimed to have inspected the window. All of them said they saw no sign of forced entry around the window, and no signs of a prowler on the ground underneath it. But notably, not a single law enforcement officer was aware of the others' prior visits to observe the area beneath the window. Nor, until after they completed their interview of her, were any of the officers aware that Gloria Jackson had also been to the area beneath the window that evening. Later, LaShone Williams and Duane Graham said they too had walked around to the rear of the house and knocked on the window to get Brewer's attention before returning to the front door and entering to watch American Gladiators. In all, 7 people, Williams, Graham, Jackson, and 4 law enforcement officers, had traipsed around the exterior of the window within a few hours of one another, and evidently not anyone or any combination of all of them had left any sign of having done so. This was a critical point. The state claimed there were no footprints around the window and no signs of forced entry. Therefore, it followed, Christine Jackson's abductor could only have been inside the house. But not only had 7 people walked in the area around and beneath the window, Permenter and his assistant had tried to hoist themselves through the window itself. A lack of footprints did not mean that no one could have walked up to the window, opened it, and reached through to grab Christine Jackson. It only meant that either the ground wasn't soft enough to preserve footprints, or the law enforcement officers weren't very good at finding them. Unfortunately for Kennedy Brewer, his defense lawyers never pursued this hole in the state's case. The state's narrative of the crime was never tenable. It went like this. Brewer raped and killed Christine while Gloria was at the Santa Barbara. At some point in the night, he carried the body several hundred yards through thick brush to deposit it into the creek. He then returned through the same thick brush to the house, cleaned up any evidence of the rape and murder, and pretended as though nothing was out of the ordinary. By the state's reckoning, he also created a lump of blankets and bedclothes roughly proportional to Christine, put those clothes on the bed, then picked them up from the bed and moved them to the pallet as if they were Christine when Jackson returned home from the club. Once it became public knowledge the following morning that Christine was missing, he, for some reason, dropped the guise of an innocent. Instead, he acted like a conscienceless sociopath, first refusing to search for the little girl, then later telling Gloria that he should have killed her instead of Christine. It was all rather absurd. As in every criminal trial, Brewer's prosecutors technically had the burden of proof. But as a practical matter, especially in murder cases, reasonable doubt alone isn't a winning defense. Brewer's lawyers needed a plausible alternative suspect, someone who had the motive and opportunity to commit the crime. Typically, that's a tall order. Law enforcement shapes the initial investigation, and if the investigation quickly focuses on one suspect, as was the case with Brewer, defense attorneys have few alternate leads. Appointed counsel for indigent defendants, like the attorneys who represented Brewer, just aren't positioned to undertake the type of robust investigation that might ferret out another plausible suspect whom law enforcement had overlooked or neglected to consider. That said, while Brewer's attorneys may not have had the resources to conduct their own investigation, they did have a closed set of potential suspects to consider: Williams, Graham, James Clayton, a former boyfriend of Gloria's, and Justin Albert Johnson. There were also easily ascertainable facts that should have separated one of those suspects from the others. Up until that time, Noxubee County had experienced one child homicide in its recent history, Courtney Smith. The two murders were, of course, remarkably similar. Johnson was the only person who at one time was a suspect in both of them. Johnson had been detained and questioned after Smith's murder, because a witness had noticed his car in the neighborhood on the night she was abducted. Johnson was also the only suspect who had been charged and convicted of other sex offenses against women, each of which involved entering the victims' homes at night. And Johnson was the only suspect with cuts on his arms, the same sorts of cuts some law enforcement officers must have sustained when walking through the thick brush near the creek while looking for the girl. Yet Brewer's attorneys never developed Johnson as a possible suspect, at least not in court. The jury was never given an alternative. Either Kennedy Brewer raped and killed Christine, or the killer was still out there and might never be caught. There is no audio recording of Brewer's trial, but on the written page, Forrest Allgood's closing argument reads like the fire and brimstone sermon of a snake-handling revivalist, right down to an altar call ending. He began with some discussion of concentric circles. I know when I was in grade school, I learned about